Welcome to the podcast of the Urban Mystic, the show focused on helping people understand and develop a practice of the presence of God so that they can shift from a relationship characterized by faith and distance to a deep, nurturing, and fulfilling relationship characterized by mutual desire and closeness. This podcast is for anyone who wants an intimate relationship with God. This includes church-going Christians, church leaders and volunteers, and those who consider themselves to be spiritual but not religious. If you enjoy this episode, I invite you to like the episode and leave a comment, to subscribe on your favorite podcast provider, and to contribute to the work of the Urban Mystic by following the link to PayPal in the show notes or the QR code on our website.
One of the things that sort of struck me about when we last spoke was this idea of, yeah, I guess the building blocks of intimacy and what that can look like and how we can kind of go about achieving that. And then we'll talk a bit more at some point about some of those need statements that I was talking through as well. But I realized kind of as well that in a way, before even perhaps when we talk about intimacy, we need to look at the idea that we have kind of obstacles to that. And we also have great maps to get to that. The things that can really take us towards a really flourishing, intimate, healthier expression of relating to myself and to others and experiencing that intimacy. And there are these blockers that happen either internally, they can be external. But I was really thinking a lot about kind of what are these blueprints that we are given often early on in our life that we sort of take on, and that for me eventually becomes part of the work of the self, is to go through these blueprints that we carry. So I would say blueprints for me are more sort of maps. We map out kind of how we understand the world and how we want to get to what we want. So let's talk about intimacy, right? And so the blueprint gives us a way in which to get towards that.
I really like the way that you put that people have internal and external obstacles. Looking back in anyone's life, we can recognize that there are experiences and events that take place that significantly impact people. That impact is internalized. There's a relationship between that story that we have within us, meaning that story or that image can serve as obstacle or map. You know, I think of things like, you take the image of a father or mother. For people that have got great experiences of in those relationships, that image can be an enabler to them being a parent and to them relating to the divine other as father or mother. For people that have had very poor relational experiences in those relationships with their own father and mother, that poor experience can be a hindrance to them, to their relating as a father or mother to their children, and it can be a hindrance to them relating to the divine with those images. And I think in that sense, none of these, well, in that sense, images are related to our experience, and our experience can present hurdles or be enablers. So even though we've got these maps or these images, they can be obstacles to some and easy maps to read for others.
I want to say that I have a picture of myself. Let's use that. I have a picture of who I am and how I understand myself to be. I've also arrived at that picture for a number of different reasons. Very often, as I'm growing up as a child, that is a vast amount of external stimuli that I've taken in. And so if I have some very simple sort of nuts and bolts of this, I have a good picture of myself. Let's say I see myself to be valuable, lovable, someone that belongs. A large amount of that picture is built from external stimuli that happens very much relationally, the kind of healthy attachment stuff that I get given when I'm a child. I'm treated by these external persons that I also, to an extent, I understand as pictures or images of a human being. I experience love. I experience belonging. I experience welcome. I experience the meeting of my needs. I experience attentiveness. I experience a bunch of things that come together to form internally this image of myself as something that is lovable. Better, someone who is lovable, someone who belongs, someone who perhaps, to add another dimension to this, if someone who, when they encounter something difficult, can receive comfort, assurance, affection, stability. And so this picture gets formed quite early on. And that is a picture to an extent that I'm given externally and that I take over more and more consciously as I grow and develop. And at some point, it's not really this simple, but at some point I take that over very consciously. And it's my job to be the custodian of that picture. There are also sort of things that happen internally, stimuli that influence, and this is why the sort of relational dynamic is so fascinating, things that happen within me, choices I make, ways in which I speak, don't speak, act, don't act, et cetera, that influence that external stimuli. There's an action, reaction, response going on, sort of multi-directional. And so as I engage with these pictures, these people from outside, I build. We try and stay with one concept at a time. I also go about co-building the picture of who I am. For example, the first time I receive a no in life, and it's, again, it's way too simple to just talk about the first time I receive a no, but, you know, I hear the message, no, and that's quite a startling message when my, to an extent, my desired experience is welcome, belonging, love, etc., which in a way are more sort of yes statements. A no statement, I don't do that, or not now, or that's not right, or whatever, can feel quite threatening. And so there is a new development within the picture. I can be someone that is both welcome, etc., and I experience that from outside and, you know, things that I do from inside that stimulate that, but also there's things that I do from inside that stimulate the action reaction of no, too loud, too noisy, too fast, too quick, too dangerous, too whatever. And let's even say for very good reasons, there's a no. Often happens from, let's say, parent to child. And that builds on the picture. Ah, okay, so I can also cause things that will perhaps, at least the perception, threaten my belonging, love, et cetera, and so it builds very, very, it builds in complexity very quickly. In terms of the picture I have of myself, what I suppose I'd want to try and differentiate between kind of the picture of myself and the blueprint is, I guess, the way I go about as I own more and more of that, the blueprint that, or perhaps as I'm a bit more conscious of it, although much of it works out subconsciously really to begin with and for a long time, kind of early on. It's the ways I go about trying to secure for myself that which is really important for me. Sort of very simple level, it would be sort of, you know, I see a nice piece of food on the table and I realize a table is a good place in this house to get food. So I would return there often because that's something that I want, something that I need. It just works the same thing for like love and belonging and whatever. And so, you know, if I get yes messages, I realize, okay, that behavior or that facial expression or that whatever, you know, think about like a kid who acts the clown because it makes people laugh and entertain. There's a blueprint there in terms of when I do these things, it gets me these things. And the blueprint in a way reinforces the image, but it's also something the image uses to navigate the world of self and the world of relationships. Now they're quite, I guess, in a way, closely related, but also distinct in that if we change the image, we can also change the blueprint. So you see that most often it's quite easiest to see if you talk about sort of really unhealthy, let's say. So it would be a really good stereotype. Negative attention, for example. Someone who's really low in attention and is really battling, you feel it's a lot with kids. Attention is a high currency sort of thing within relationships. And it's also very, very important for the formation of self, for the healthy formation of self. But a child who doesn't receive much of that, so basically does not get a lot of what they really need in terms of attention, will find other ways to get what they want. So again, very, very simplified statement, but the food is not on the table, they're still hungry, they're going to take it out the cupboard. And even if there's a punishment associated with taking the food out of the cupboard, they're hungry. They're going to take the food out of the cupboard. It's the same thing for, you know, sort of the real stereotype, quote unquote, children acting out. It's, oh, it's looking for attention. Well, of course they are. They're fucking starving. So of course they are, right? And so in a way, there's an image of self that sort of, that has something to do with how they navigate in terms of there's some sort of subconscious, you know, this is what I need, this is who I am. And perhaps the image I have is of someone who, you know, I'm not the kind of person who gets to go to the table and receive their food there. That would be an image statement, a picture statement. I'm the kind of person who would have to steal it from the cupboard. This is a very sophisticated statement for a child, so no child will really make that statement, but it's kind of process. The blueprint is kind of the, okay, if I pay attention to when mom or dad is not looking or whatever, and then I can go to the cupboard, well, I know if they're upstairs, I'm downstairs, I can navigate in this way to get really what I, quote unquote, need. Now, a healthier image and a healthier blueprint would be related in so much as a healthier image, let's say externally, to begin with, a healthier father or mother image, that person who is putting food on the table builds a healthier image in the individual, in the child, but also allows the child to build healthy maps, healthy blueprints to figure out how they go about getting things. That healthy child will become a healthy adult who understands, you know, that food is a good thing and it's okay. I'm allowed to, and that's a very simple analogy, it's stretching to breaking point, but I'm allowed to put food on the table. I'm allowed to enjoy food. Food is not this thing that I need to sneak around and maybe get, maybe not. Do I steal it? Do I not? Am I allowed it? You know, that is still locked in a very unhealthy image, picture of self. And then that sort of interrelates with this idea of this map or this blueprint that they use to navigate. And so you'll get kind of picture of self and then sort of actions in the world in a way. It's a very, very simple way, I think, to think about it, but perhaps for where we are now. So if you clear up the image, you can also start to clear up the blueprints. Sometimes if you start to clear up the blueprints, you can also start to clear up the images. I guess perhaps one of the things I'm trying to work towards is that as we get older, the shocking truth that we're presented with is the picture of ourselves does really belong to us. And it is our, for lack of a better phrase, job. It is our opportunity. It is our privilege. It is a number of other things. It is also our incredible deep hardship to go about refining the image of who we are. And to let go of some of the things that we have allowed. And allowed sounds possibly a bit judgmental. It's not like, you naughty child, why did you allow that? You know, a lot of this stuff gets stuck to us before we have a filter to go, well, that's crap. Of course I'm lovable. It's rubbish. It comes really in before we are sophisticated enough to make those things. And so when we reach that level of sophistication, we're allowed the opportunity to go, okay, maybe this, you know, to go back to the story thing that I was talking about, I think in the last episode, does this belong in my story, this picture of who I am? And does this picture of who I am, does this get me where I need to go? Does this fuel my blueprint? Is it a healthy blueprint? And so a healthy picture of who I am, a healthy story, a healthy image can look at an unhealthy blueprint and go, oh, this is not taking me where I need to go. Why? Because I know myself to be a person who should go to a better place, you know? I don't need to steal food from the cupboard. I'm someone of value that could sit at the table and I deserve food at the table. And that's good. I can say that of myself. And that really becomes our job. And that's where I believe so firmly that the self is the vehicle to the self-self relationship and completely into the relationship with others. Because the more we clear up that image, the more we're able to bring that image into whatever relationship we have. And we also then are able to build better and better blueprints, which we use relationally to go about getting our relational needs met. And that's a function of the sort of the quality of the relationship, is being able to use better and better blueprints. For example, one of the things that I've learned, so that I've sort of picked through from when I was a child. So my father was not very good at, no, let me begin that again. I don't think my father had a great blueprint for navigating needs and relationships and relational quality. I also am more and more convinced that he must have had a very low image of himself. And so one of the things, what that looked like in relationship, was my dad battled to come and say, hey, I really need you to do this for me, in a very connective way. And one of the ways he would ask for help, if I can put it that simply, around the house, is he would walk into a room and he'd start sighing. And he would start picking up a simple little thing that you think means nothing, but actually for me, I realized, wow, the significance of it. He would come in to clean up dirty dishes and dirty glasses. And instead of coming in and saying, hey guys, we all live in this home together, and I just want to tell you that part of that is this blueprint I want to teach you. So there we go. That would be an external stimuli kind of teaching of a blueprint that would come from a healthy image bearer, the person, my father. Hey, living together, we're all going to do something to keep this place looking good. It's going to work for me. It's going to work for everyone. It's going to help you with your image. You know, this is kind of weird language, but go with it. He wouldn't say this necessarily, but this is kind of the subtext. It's going to help you with your image as well, because if you live in a cleaner place, you think differently about yourself, blah, blah, blah. You're looking after yourself, whatever. So what I'm going to ask you guys to do is that when you're finished eating, you'd clean up your own plates and cups. You take them to the kitchen, you wash them, put them in the dishwasher, whatever it was. We were pre-dishwasher technology in those days. You know, this is what I need, because this is how I understand myself, and this is how I work out this map towards, you know, the meaning in my life and what I need. I can voice these things well, communicate, et cetera, et cetera. This is what I want you to do. And then, you know, we were teenagers. He would have had to put a boundary there because we would have needed that. So it's also part of it, but I'm not going to talk about boundaries now. Instead of doing that, he used to come in and he used to sigh and he used to pick up one dish at a time and clatter them together. He would make a lot of noise. And all it did was annoy the living shit out of all of us. Myself, I had two siblings. So something perhaps within him was unable to voice, hey, this is what I really need. There was a picture thing in terms of who he was. And the blueprint he had to go about getting what he needed, to ask for the attention of actually, this is what I need, was to come in and make a lot of noise and basically be a nuisance to try and communicate, hey, this is what I need from you. And all he would achieve with that blueprint, that map, it would take him towards a friction in our relationship, and not a good friction, an unhelpful friction. So he didn't get what he wanted from that, what he needed. We didn't get, as budding, you know, sort of growing pictures and images, we didn't get that input. And we were also given a blueprint, an example of this is how you go about getting what you need. So quite unhealthy all around. And as an adult, I realize, oh man, sometimes when I'm pissed off, I do that. I walk through a kitchen and slam doors and, you know, clean up aggressively. And my wife has said to me a couple of times, yes, you're cleaning aggressively. What's going on? And you think, how the hell do you know that? Oh, because this is how ludicrous this thing can look like on the surface when we're acting out this blueprint. What I'm looking for is A, but my map, my blueprint is taking me to B. I'm going to be very frustrated because what I want is A, but I'm getting to B. And part of that is because the image starts me off in a certain direction. The image in terms of how I see myself and how I can sort of be connected with myself. So if I want to feel better within me, and if I want to have better relationships, I need to clear up my own image, and I need to find better blueprints, better maps to get me towards where I need to be, so that I can orient towards A, And the blueprint that I use, the map I use, actually gets me to A in a very healthy way.
I really like that interplay between image and blueprints. And one of the signs of adulthood, or one of the signs of responsibility really there that I hear very clearly, is that you're seeing yourself as formed in the context of relating at a younger age, and you're seeing yourself as you're behaving and forming others and being encountered by others today, but that you're also able to articulate a sense of understanding and compassion for your father and relating to him rather than just blaming him, which is, yeah, I mean, it's an incredibly healthy thing to hear. So there's definitely that to start, but I think overall that relation to the table and to food is an incredibly good image to work with, also because it's one that's given to us in the context of spirituality. You know, there's, well, and I suppose by referring to that, I think I'm perhaps hinting very clearly and intentionally at how we can get given tremendously, we can be presented with an image that is actually incredibly unhealthy, and we can continue relating to it in unhealthy ways, in the sense that we're living by faith and living faithfully. And that image is the image of the, you know, the Samaritan coming to Jesus and saying, hey, you know, can we also get some of this kingdom stuff? And him saying, actually, no, this stuff isn't for you. And the response being, hey, even the dogs eat scraps that are thrown off the table. And Jesus' response is, as I see it and understand it, a reevaluation where he looks and he realizes that perhaps he needs to be more inclusive. Maybe I've got to find a better way to phrase that. That as Jesus listens to that, his response is to say, hey, in the house of Israel, I don't see faith like this. You know, meaning that there's a sense of legitimacy there from someone that has always seen themselves as inferior to come and ask him for something, because there's a sense that I'm worth it. I might not be worth very much, but I'm worth the scraps that you can toss me. And yet Jesus is understanding himself to be in the context of people who should be dining at the table. You know, they've got legitimacy to dine at the table, and they're not. And that image goes together with others, you know, the filling of the lamps, you know, the people that are supposed to be prepared and aren't, and what's been offered them gets taken away, you know, et cetera, et cetera. The parable of the talents, you know, there's a number of other images that actually elaborate on this as well. The sense of like, what are you entitled to? What are you allowed to show up for? What is your relationship with this? And even in healthy environments, people can develop unhealthy relationships. I think that's something that's very important to consider as well. You know, that we can wrestle in a context with something that's very unhealthy. Like you say, you know, am I allowed to go to the table in the kitchen and prepare myself food? Can I open the fridge and take food out? There are many people that grow up without that as part of their life experience, or their life experience basically says, you're not permitted this. You might be a child that lives in this home, or you might not be a child that lives in this house that is not your home, and you're not entitled to that. And that will tremendously impact someone.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose at that point, the simple way to articulate it may be that images can be incredibly simple to some, because they are secure in relationships, and because they had healthy early relations that enable that image to be seamless for them. And for other people, that same imagery that's very freeing for some people can serve as a continuously reinforcing trap, barrier, or obstacle to them. And this image of food could easily be replaced by any number of other images, be they personal or impersonal. Those personal and impersonal images can equally serve as ways to free people and open them up in their relationship to self, others, and God, and they can continue to reinforce or trap people and stand as obstacles to them relating to self, others, and God. Does that sound simple? Yeah, I mean, I use simple there quite yes and no. quite loosely because it's actually not that simple.
I think I'm with you to an extent. I think it is easier at sort of this level to say, if you had a good, let's just start with these two. If you had a good father or mother experience, it is far easier to relate in a more healthy way to, let's, if we talk about divine to self, the divine parental, right? The good father, good mother, picture of God to self. I think it's easier. You have a better calibrated image of the father and mother divine. And so then you will use, hopefully, also better calibrated blueprints, maps to get you somewhere in terms of that relationship there. Using the picture of food, you would say to God, perhaps, I don't know, any number of things. I think that's where it gets complex, but let's just pick one. I'm going to the fridge to get something to eat. You would embody, it's one of the most confusing lines I've ever found. My favorite passage in all of the Gospels, probably all of the New Testament, is the story of the lost son, the boy who runs away and takes half of his inheritance from his father. And it's so beautiful because there's so many different things going on there. But you have the young son, you have the older brother, you have the father, these three key pivotal. And in the first half of the story is very much about the young son and the father. And the second half of the story is very much about the older brother and the father. Now, the older brother, different to the young son, does not run away, does not say to his father, "You're dead to me. Give me my share of the inheritance." What he says to the father is, you know, you've never let me go to the fridge. You've never treated me like a son. I'm like a slave. I work all the time for you, and I don't have the right to go to the fridge and eat. And equally, I find the father's response then to be incredibly poignant, but also quite confusing, because it's a piece that I haven't been able to wrap my head around. And the father says, "But everything I have is yours," as if to say, how on earth did you grow up in this household and arrive at the conclusion that my fridge is not your fridge, that my table is not your table? How on earth can you grow up as my son in this household and see yourself as a slave and not see yourself as my son, right? So that has an imagery thing there. The son sees himself not as a son, but equal to, and sorry, forgive the loaded language for anyone who's listening. It's an old story from 2,000 years ago. He sees himself as a slave or a worker within the household rather than someone who belongs to the father, who exhibits, you know, ownership and stewardship over this whole thing, and would see himself having to ask for anything and everything. You think, how is that possible? How does he miss that? How does he see himself as that? Which then leads him to then have a blueprint, which is, I can't have things from the fridge. I don't get that, even though I want that. So I need to go and, you know, and then the story says, you know, spends all his time out working in the field. So if I go out and work in the field and do all this thing, then that will gain me access to perhaps my father's table or to some scraps, perhaps even, or whatever. Just not taking him where he wants to go or where he needs to go. So it's a faulty blueprint held by a faulty image. And where was I going with that? Why did it remind me of that? Yeah, it's that picture of like, of if you have the full image, if you see yourself as this son in this father's household, then no son says, "Please, daddy, I have a sandwich." If they're old enough, and they know how to make a sandwich, they just make a sandwich because they believe the Father, you know, in the story, whatever I have is yours. You belong. You have full expression of the image of who you are. And here's a blueprint for how to move relationally within the, you know, the dynamic between you and I within the household, et cetera, et cetera. But the faulty image and the faulty blueprint leads to statements like, yeah, you've never given me so much as a goat to share between me and my friends. Again, it's a little bit of a, it's an imagery from 2000 years ago. But
I'm loving your treatment of this classic parable, largely because I feel like every time I hear people focus on it, they focus on the young son, his entitlements and his realization that there's, you know, that he's actually got a place, he's got a home, and he can just go back to it. You know, he's going to be welcomed. So they focus on his understanding of the relationship with the father rather than the misunderstanding of the older son and where they're at. And they contrast in a way that doesn't go into the depth that I feel that you're going into there. I'm really loving your treatment of that.
I will have to be very, very quick on the heels of that and say I am deeply indebted to Henri Nouwen, the Dutch theologian, for his incredible insight into this story, and his work on it has really led me by the hand very deeply into the three characters there. And so I'll share another piece of what he sees in that I think is helpful when we look at this kind of this image and the blueprint kind of idea. But what I was thinking is the older brother in this story is left. We find him in the story with, a broken picture of who he is. And to an extent, I think there's a bit of a breadcrumb trail to how he, to understand his blueprint for what it means to get what he needs. So he sees himself as less than a son, and he pursues these ways of being to try to get what he needs within the family, within his relationship with his father, from that image. And so I think one of the really key things for me in relational health, if I think self to self, self to other, self to divine, is to start to do the work of clearing up. Now, building a better image, drawing a better picture of myself, telling a better story over time. So letting go of some of the things, for example, in this one, the older brother can let go of the part of the image where he holds on to that this is who I am. I'm not a son in this relationship with my father. I'm actually more like a hired person, a hired hand, I think is actually better language if I think it's the translation of how he talks about himself. You know, I'm an employee. I don't belong to my father and my father to me in this way. Actually, we have this transactional relationship. And therefore, I transact in these ways. That's the blueprint to get what I need here. And so I would want to put two sort of immensely complex pictures, sort of things on the table, but try and really just put them simply. I would say there's an internal and external thing going on here in terms of if we're going to draw a better picture for ourselves, of our self to self, and then the relationships that we have, self to other and self to divine. So if I notice, okay, there's a story I tell about myself, there's a picture I have of myself, right? I can do the work around refining that, drawing a new picture, editing my story. And there's a lot that goes into that. It's not just as simple as that, but that is the work. I need to do the work on the vehicle that is myself in terms of how I relate to myself and then how I would relate to the other and to the divine other. And so there's an internal thing. There's something that can sort of begin, I wouldn't say begin and end in me. That's too simple, but I'm going to say begin and end in me. There's an internal process to this as I refine that. But there's also often an external element. And so it's neither of these are exclusive, and they work very much in a dynamism together. There's an action-reaction thing going on there as well. But there are things outside. In relationship, the other as it relates to me as myself, can cause stimuli that can change my picture of myself. And I think some of the most powerful examples are really sort of deeply embodied presence. And so you have an experience. It's different. So someone can come to you and say, "Oh, but Steve, you could actually be quite lovable." That's one thing. If I have somebody who is healthily in tune with themselves and they come and they love me and I experience that love, that welcome, that belonging from them, that is a very powerful external stimuli that prompts, stimulates my internal recalibration of myself. It'll change my image. It really can. And so I can notice, let me stick with the story of this older brother. If I'm him, I can notice, I'm tired of being an employee. I don't like that feeling. If I reflect on this, I think to myself, oh, what I experience in this family is, oh, I have a father. Oh, and I have a name, son. And that means something. And yet I see myself as an employee. But fathers who have sons don't have fathers who have employees. Employees are different things. So there's an incongruence there that I can recalibrate around and go, sure, maybe the one can fall away and I can embrace the other. Very simply, that could be the internal process. But what I love in this story is the father provides the external stimuli, which is the question, but everything that I have is yours. And there's this sort of, hang on, if I tap on the glass and go, why do you see yourself as an employee? For me, is kind of the subtextual question. How would you see yourself? How can you have an image that is so off from how I would see you, let's say? So if I think about myself again, times that have deeply moved me in my life is, I think of myself as unlovable. And I come up against someone who expresses great love to me. That's very jarring. I think, oh, this is not how I know myself. Someone worthy of love. This is uncomfortable. And at the same time, man, it's very nice to go to the table and have someone say, look, food, isn't it nice? Eat. And the thing that I'm so desperately wanting, I realize, oh, okay, maybe I can be that person who sits at the table. What it also does is it messes with my blueprint, because then I'm going, well, hang on, I don't have to steal this food. It's just here. I don't have to go through some kind of weird way to try and find love and affection, attention, belonging, etc. Oh, it's just given, and it stimulates something within me. It can stimulate my image of myself if I will allow it, and then the blueprints. And so I think those two processes, that sort of simple level, really sort of mutually interact with each other. And it's not, I wouldn't want to communicate a sense of you have to start this in yourself, or it can only start externally. If somebody says, well, which is it? I would say, yes. I think they're all happening all the time. Yeah, it's a very, very much a both and. And there's a sense of what we are ready for, what we will allow, what we will notice, what we can then even stimulate within ourselves around readiness, allowing, noticing. And there are external stimuli situations that are powerful enough to do the same, to stimulate, allowing, noticing, being ready for, etc. Some of these things come, unasked for, and we're surprised even. So, readiness is sort of kicked out in front of us. Oh, okay, maybe I'm being loved. This is uncomfortable. Stop it. Oh, actually, that's really nice. Okay, maybe I like it. No, but stop it. Oh, but like it. Oh, stop it, but I like it. And so these things happen sort of together all the time. And so in that, then, if I come back to the self again, because I really think that is kind of, that's the only thing around which I can really truly orbit, because it's the only thing I really sort of own, for lack of a better word, is the self. I can then become a healthier picture of me, can build healthier blueprints for how I navigate this life relationally. And then that leads me to one of the things that I find most beautiful about this story that I'm deeply indebted to Henri Nouwen. He says one of the real trajectories of this story is that both the younger and the older son are given the same invitation to no longer remain sons, but to become like the Father. And that's always really struck me as like, wow, it's not just a simple story about kind of these kids, but there is a trajectory in their image towards becoming like this Father. And I think that for me is a great sort of hopeful statement around my image and my blueprints, those things I would hope on the trajectory towards healthier and healthier. And that, you know, you said something earlier about, you know, we're in a trajectory, we're in a process as well, but there are also snapshots, you know. And if you look at the snapshots of both of these two sons, we're given a number of snapshots to the story of where they're at. You know, the youngest one is the easiest because he's running away, then he's running back, you know. And if you stop the story too soon, he's just running away. And if you stop it, he's just running back, uncertain. And you don't get that beautiful conclusion of the welcome home and the, you know, the reintegration and all the rest of that stuff. So there's process, but there's also, there's points along the journey that I think we notice and that we can rest in and that we can grow in. And there's, it require our attention in that. And that's part of the slow, okay, long-term trajectory of, yeah, building a better story, a better image, a better picture, and then hopefully also building better blueprints and maps to get us where we need to go. And then I think possibly the last thing that I'd say there is that then I think the divine other is so unbelievably instrumental in creating, I don't know, atmosphere, relationship, external stimuli that can really nurture and encourage that trajectory. And I think also, and that's what just strikes me now, he's also incredibly generous and very patient with the snapshots. Doesn't weight them too much, I think, in terms of my sense is leans more to the trajectory than just the snapshots. Which is not to say our running away or running towards God would mean the same thing for God. But I get the sense of in the encouragement into the journey towards a purer sense of self, the true self the mystics would talk about instead of the false self, the journey towards the true self. I really get the sense of real warm welcome and invitation from God, from the divine other, towards that trajectory. And perhaps even in that modeling an allowance for us to hold the snapshots of our lives somewhat gently and notice the momentum and the process rather than, because I think we can be very kind of stuck in the picture now. And I think that's why we get our images stuck. Well, I'm just a hired employee. I'm not worth anything. Okay. Well, you could let go of that. And I think God provides that. Saying that too simply, but there was just a sense as well there in terms of what we're talking about. Anyway, Cephas, I've gone on and on and on for a long time. What do you think?
Absolutely brilliant is what I think.
Yeah. And incoherent. I find it quite frustrating, but it's tricky territory.
It is. I think it points to how complex these simple images play out in relation to different people. You know, like on one hand, we can identify with one person or other, usually the one son or other in the story. But we can also miss something, because I think often we close the story too early. And here there's the picture of the divine as someone who doesn't close its story early, but holds the process open and is willing to be authentic without be welcoming in a way of the young son in a way that can be seen to compromise his value. I mean, he goes running after the son as soon as he spots him. But on the other hand, and so he's taken a risk in giving the inheritance to the son and in running towards his son. And in relation to the other son, there's the challenge of calling him out, of saying, you actually haven't grown into what's been available to you all along, and I want you to. So there's a challenge and a calling in there as well that could also be seen as a like a compromise of self on a level. And yet in both cases, it's an inviting to become like him. So there's something tremendously valuable there. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's a powerful story. Well, powerful parable because of the ways in which we can relate to it. I think the one thing that is often missed, I was working today on just again, like revisiting the practice of the presence of God and noting that there's a tremendous difference between a reflective or what's considered a contemplative approach to spirituality that will meditate upon this, you know, such contemplative meditation. There's, I'm going to meditate upon the story and I need to rework my thinking. And that very much taps into what you were saying and what we were saying here tonight, you know, that we can take ownership, we can take custodianship of ourselves and these images. And in telling the story to myself and others, I can rewrite that story. And if I visit a story like this or a parable like this, and I use it as a mirror, and I engage myself through this, I can transform myself. And on that level, I think we're speaking about what we'd call acquired contemplation. We're speaking about how we take ownership, how we work on things like this, and through that work, we're going to transform ourselves. And yet something that we've touched on in the past and something that we're using these images in this conversation as a touchstone is towards encountering the transcendent divine person as someone who becomes present to us. And that the story can be a vehicle to which we can arrive at an openness or an invitation to wait on God for God to become manifest or to become present to us in a very concrete, tangible, direct one-on-one way. Very often in the context of spirituality and in the context of, you know, this is a story from the New Testament, in the context of church, it's often preached. We often stop short. You know, we stop short on the one side of the story, and that is that you, Steve, me, Tim, we must take responsibility for how we see ourselves. Which son do we identify with? What is our story in relation to legitimacy here? And let's rework that. And I've got to, within my self-image, go from seeing, well, for me, seeing myself as the illegitimate son to seeing myself as the legitimate son. And then I'm going to be okay. But I've got to be responsible for that. There's very little in spirituality and in how spirituality is put forward that has the sense that God can become present to me as well and be an other that I engage in relation to the story that I have about myself. And that is really hard because I think we also don't have good experiences of engaging an other in a human-to-human environment, really being able to tell that story of how we see ourselves and being received and seen and engaged. And that engagement and that transformation in relation to the other being the kind of relationship that the other reshapes us by their presence, by their love, by their acceptance, by their hearing our story at a really deep level and holding space for us and coming back with a difference, with an engagement, because we're often shaped into these stories by experiences that we have with others before we're conscious. Now we're in the process where we're conscious. We can't tell these stories because of the shame, fear, and rejection that we struggle with, to become the naked self in relation to the others, to face rejection. So how do we do that with someone? And how do they engage us in a way that's transformative and redemptive and healing for us? Most of us struggle to have those experiences, including in relationship with our deep partners, you know, our life partners, our romantic others, our spouses. We struggle to do that. And yet it's also the kind of thing that we struggle with in relation to God, because we're basically told in so many ways that we don't have legitimate access to a relationship with God like that. We cannot approach God and say, I want to engage you. It's possible for me to engage you. I know that that's possible. At least I've heard that it's possible because there's all these stories of other people engaging you. You know, it's not even easy for us to get to that point and say, well, if they could, then I could too. or if you could engage them, perhaps you could gauge me too. And there's something powerful in being able to tell our story to another and for them to see us and to meet us in that. In my telling stories to you and you receiving me, I get to feel safety, acceptance. That becomes redemptive and transformative to me. It changes my self-image towards being someone that is loved and accepted and valued. And there can be a deficit in my life. I mean, I would say that there is. And that's the same for all of us. And yet in the relationship with the divine, we could have that too, except we often feel like we've got to do the work for the divine because that relationship is not available to us.
So if I pause for a second, I think the parallel there would be if I use that, because I think this has been profitable for us. We talk about the human-to-human interactions, right, as somewhat of a sketch of human to divine. So if I use that example, you've come to me and told me a part of your story, and you have experienced from me some form of welcome, love, belonging, acceptance, etc., that has impacted you, right? Is sort of what you're saying. The parallel would be, in terms of what we talk about with God, would be in a way, if maybe this is a bit crude or simple, perhaps you would sit with yourself and you would think, oh, if I come and tell this part of my story to Steve, then I would experience ABC and that would set me free and I would really be whatever. Let's just pick an easy one, loved. But you stop short of then actually coming and doing that with me because you've been able to wrap that up within yourself quite simply. And so what you don't step forward into is the risk to do that with another, because it can also go the other way, right? So it's risky. But if it goes well, you experience a few things, but simply now you would experience being loved by me, let's say. But when we talk about the self to the divine, we're often internalizing it as if it has happened in a way. But there is no relational back and forth in that. There is no experience of that. It's kind of what I hear you saying, if I think about, is that kind of my tracking with what you're saying? Which is when you think in the human, is ludicrous. Like if I said to you, hey, Tim, yesterday, I thought about telling you this thing about myself because I really felt that you would get me and you'd understand and I would feel, you know, I'd feel good about that, telling that, I'd be seen and heard and whatever. And you say, well, what is it? Oh, I'm not going to tell you. It's enough that I anticipate that would be the response. And now I feel good about myself. I'm all healed. You would go, well, Steve, that's a pseudo interaction. It's one thing to entertain that in your head, that's going somewhere. But until you actually step out and say, hey, Tim, let me tell you this thing about myself and take the risk, maybe you'll go, or, wow, I see you, I hear you. It's not a true interaction. It's an intraaction. And that is a lot of what our spirituality is keyed towards. You know, interestingly, I think about it, the young son does exactly that in that story. When he's struggling with the pigs, he says, I'll go back to my dad and I'll say this. And there's the implication that everything will then be okay. Okay. And he says, I'll go back and say, it's terrible and I'm not good enough to be your kid anymore, but just take me on as an employee. And he does that internal process. And then as the story plays out, he comes back and then he actually does it out loud. And what's fascinating for me in the story is he only gets halfway through his little speech before the father changes the course of things. Now, if he'd never risked that, if he just stayed in the pigs and thought, oh, well, there we go, that's resolved it. I'm not good enough to be a kid anymore. I can just be an employee. But he never reaches out and actually has the interaction. That's very much the spirituality, is still sitting in the pig shit going, well, glad we cleared that up. I need to actually go to the father and have the interaction. And both sons get an interactive experience because the elder one also, he risks and says, well, you know, I'm not good enough to be your kid. What the hell? And he goes, but you always have been. And that is an interactive. I really track with you on that, because that is That is super powerful. It's not powerful enough to only be contained within me.
What's powerful about that parable is you've got the one son in an impoverished non-relationship, like away from his father, and you've got the other son in a wealthy, impoverished relationship. And so the poverty and the wealth in which they live is contrasted, and yet they are both in an impoverished relationship because neither have fully entered into a healthy sonship. And one could easily miss that on a surface level, on a surface reading of that story. And if it was told to an outsider and both sons came up and the father was away and there was someone representing the household, they could have taken them back and just put them to work, given them a room, board, lodging, whether it was in the stable or was within the house, whether it was the food that the servants ate or the food in the main household. That wouldn't change the nature of the relationship or the nature of the non-relationship. So it's pivotal here that the engagement is with the father. And I think in many ways, to have faith as a substitute, to have faith as the mirror, is to not complete that journey. We actually need relational encounter. You need God to draw near in person to engage you for that transformation to really carry through. And I think a lot of our spirituality actually stops short of that. Certainly as I understand, and I'm not knocking our spirituality as much as I'm saying without this focus that you and I are talking about on this podcast, without this focus on the immediacy of God and the manifest presence of God, our spirituality is incomplete. It's not to say that the other things that we do is not valuable.
It's something that's just been sort of gnawing at me. Well, you've said this a few times, and I suddenly just clicked. Your use of the word mirror is so brilliant, because a mirror is great for what it does, but it's useless for something else. So a mirror is a great space for me to stand in front of and have myself reflected back to me. But it's not a great window through which I can look and see another, you know? And so I think mirror work, important, very, very important. But only mirror work, well, we know the danger of that, of what it means to be completely wrapped up within the self, which is why the self-to-self relationship is only one of the three that we talk about, because there is an ecosystem there. It's not just me and myself, and therefore I have enough. And I think we've been saying that in other ways in the past around, you know, the faith is essentially, in a way, a me and myself. It's a low-risk relationship where I play the part for me and for God. Faith plays the part for God, but that's still very much a me in the driving seat thing. You see this in poor relationship. That's the my needs matter, yours don't. It's about me. It's not so much about the give and take in the relationship, you know. You see it in all the bad building blocks of relationships, conflict, communication, those sorts of things where there isn't a B A cycle. It's really just held within the person of A or B. There is no back and forth. Then it's very stagnant. It can only go so far. It's one of the reasons why, like, people who are really battling with anxiety, who do this thing where they have conversations with the person that they're in conflict with in their head, and that's the only place they have conversation. That's why that's so damn dangerous. Because, yeah, you can only give what you have in terms of yourself. You can't embody the other person. It doesn't matter if we switch gears quickly now, it doesn't matter how much of the Bible you read. I don't think you can speak for God, because that young son spent his life at home and got it wrong, and the older one too, and missed something key in who the father was. And I think it's the same thing. You can say, well, I know all the Bible verses, so I would think for this situation, this is applicable. And you miss the chance to be surprised. And if there's no surprise, and that's, I think, one of our first recordings from this season, we talk about the mystery element. If there's no further movement into, oh, who are you? Oh, something new. That becomes then an interactive element in what it is for us to experience relationship. Well, yeah, that relationship is not growing. It's not moving. And it's not dynamism. It's very stagnant to just be like, well, I know what my wife will always say, what my husband will always say. I know what my kids will always say. That's where we trap people and say, well, I hold your story. No, they can surprise us. They can do things differently. And I think that's what that's what I hear you saying very much, where we're pushing for in a spirituality that says, let God speak. Let God act. And a mirror cannot do that. And that's where we have to know the distinction between the self-to-self relationship and the self-to-divine. And I would also say the self-to-other. And as much important, I would think the other way around, like, you cannot get confused in the self-to-other relationship with the self-to-self. We have to know what the self-to-self is and be able to experience ourselves as distinct. That's part of one of the sort of markers for mature relationship. I can experience myself as a distinct other to you and know that I'm relating with you. You're different to me, even though we can be similar. And there's a back and forth. So I know what is the me and me relationship, but I know what the me is you relationship, and I don't confuse them. And I also don't think either suffice, because the me-you relationship, and there's no me-me relationship. One of the destinations on that route, on that road, is codependency and enmeshment and all sorts of other very unhelpful things. So I like your use of the word mirror. That's what it's been gnawing at me. That's good.